This is Michael Richman with Bushane Vineyards. I'm the general manager here and the executive winemaker, and I invite you to visit our winery or learn more about it on our website at bushane.com, and Bushane is spelled B-O-U-C-H-A-I-N-E. We make an array of wines, concentrating mostly on Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from the Carneris region, but some other fun wines like Pinot Meunier, Pinot Blanc. We make a Rosé, we make a Syrah. You can learn about these intriguing variations on a theme at our website.
Thank you for listening to iWine Radio. I'm Lynn Crelo Chamberlain.
Welcome to Wine and Dine.
I've been studying wines here for probably about the same length of time, or maybe a little bit less than our guest here, Michael Richmond. Michael Richmond is general manager and winemaker at Bushane Vineyards. And I say this because I remember when the name of the property was Domaine Bushane. Michael Richmond is known in winemaking circles, and I would imagine in the press as well, as Mr. Carneros himself. And he has this reputation because he's been working in Carneros for 30 years. He co-founded Acacia Winery in 1979 and has been at Bushane Vineyards as general manager and winemaker since 2002. The property is owned by Tatiana and Garrett Copeland, and they purchased the property in 1981. We're going to learn all about the history because they basically, that couple had to have quite a bit of faith in the property. When you go on the website, you will see the pictures and what I'm talking about. And there's a very good possibility that later on in the year, we'll have the pleasure of meeting Mrs. Copeland, who speaks five languages. Michael, thank you so very much for your time today.
Lynn, you've certainly done your homework. That just cut out half of my discussion. Half of what I had to say. So now I got to figure out what I'm going to say. Tell you about.
Listen, I have a lot of questions to ask you, so don't worry. So let's start, if you don't mind, since we're talking about Bushane here, let's talk about the history of the property from your perspectives. You weren't there in 1981 when they purchased it, but you weren't that far away in Acacia in 1979.
I was just down the street, like literally a mile away. And the story of Bushane, certainly it starts with the Copelands in a different place, and it starts, and the potential for Carneris starts at a different time as well, 10 years earlier. I've been in the business sure for 30 years, but also for 10 years prior to that, prior to starting Acacia, I was at Freemark Abbey Winery.
Yeah.
And I lived through the era of great doubt regarding Pinot Noir. So their vision and commitment to Carneris was preceded by a much broader commitment by a few people to Pinot Noir itself. Wine writers back in the 70s said scathing things about efforts to make Pinot Noir in the New World. That's all, of course, lost in history because people now, winemakers now, are consumers and wine writers accept Pinot Noir as just another variety that we make. But back in the 70s, they said really nasty things about all the wines that were coming out of the New World for Pinot Noir.
Are any of those are any of those people in the press still writing about wine today? I mean, have you witnessed any of them swallowing their words?
Ah, that's an interesting question. Probably not. Probably not. Back in the 70s, the wine press was not at the level of sophistication or intensity that it has today. And I don't remember. I mean, at that time, I wasn't as savvy as I am now, so I wouldn't have known to commit those folks to memory even. I just know that when I started making Pinot, it was in the face of a torrent of doubt.
So, and exactly, and I was reading that you, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, what does it feel like to take on the doubting wine press? But so, kind of as a segue to that question, what were you doing before Freemark Abbey and taking on this this job of making wine from Pinot Noir. Does your background wine studies at one of the academic institutions in California?
Fremark Abbey was my academic institution.
Okay.
I started out mowing the yard and working in the cellar. I was hired as a tour guide, but nobody came to visit, so I had to do every job. And so I learned everything from lab to bottling to wine etiquette to winery protocol, winemaking protocol, my introduction to wine science. I took short courses. My exposure was the wine industry was really primitive in the 70s.
And you started at Fremark Abbey in 1970?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow. So were you like right out of high school or something?
I'm 69 right now, so that tells you something. I was in my early 20s,
okay,
thinking I was going to be a teacher and having to go back to school because I was raised in Texas. And so I just started there for the romance of wine. And the romance of wine is what's kept me involved in wine, actually, all these years.
So how
did you... The romance of wine and the community of wine.
Oh, that's a good point. Oh, that's a really good point, the community of wine. I think that's what keeps me going.
Yes, ma'am. That's and I say ma'am because I'm from Texas.
I hear you.
You have to put up with it.
I hear you. I've lived 18, almost 19 years in North Carolina, so I hear you.
Hey, you know the South.
Yeah. So how did you get from Texas then up to Napa Valley?
I took a bicycle trip across the United States after I graduated from college and came through the Napa Valley and was romantically inclined to remain here, and so I did. And then started Acacia Winery in 1979 through a quirk of circumstances and fixated on the Carneros region, which actually was not a designated region at that time.
Yeah.
It didn't become a American Viticultural Area, AVA, until 1983, Napa Valley being the first one, and then the Carneros being quickly thereafter became a sub-appellation of Napa Valley as an approved viticultural area. So I've watched the Carneros grow from its infancy as regarded as an approved viticultural area up to its current level of prominence. Of course, it was planted sporadically before then. Bouchain Vineyard, we kind of take false credit for it being the oldest continuing operating winery because the Bouchain actually started in 1981, but back at the turn of the century, this building was built, like in the 20s, I guess, and there was actually vineyards here in the late 1800s. But the Carneros was very sparsely planted to vineyards throughout. It was not looked on as a very viable wine-growing region. Napa Valley, with its deep soils, mountains, and though that was the region that was looked on as wine growing, and down here in the fog and the wind and the mucky clay was not considered conducive to great wine. And so it's taken a long period for this region to come into its own as a respected world-class region for growing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay especially.
Could you put your name to an individual or a winery that who came up with this idea of trying to make wine and planting Pinot Noir?
Okay, there are two phases to the history. One was the initial plantings of Andre Chelichev and Louis Martini.
Okay,
but they back in the 40s and the 50s, but they didn't really capitalize and recognize the full potential of the region. I credit Francis Mahoney or Frank Mahoney of Carneros Creek Winery and now Mahoney Vineyards with being the true pioneer. He's the one that planted an array of, in 1972, planted an array of clones and really got started with a commitment to the Carneros region. My coming along in 19, ZD Winery also sponsored a lot of grapes and wine from this region.
Okay. Wow. Were you ever involved in your career in the politics of all this Appalachian development? That means yes.
Well, Maybe. You know, I wasn't a an active politician. I was involved in the founding of the Carneros Quality Alliance, which was happened shortly thereafter, and it has now been called the Carneros Wine Alliance. But it was a group of growers and wineries who were trying to not just promote the wines, but actually improve the quality of the wines and the recognition of the region, because it was it came from nowhere, and no one had ever heard of Carneros, and so it was a part of a publicity campaign as well as helping each other to learn how to grow grapes down in this inclement climate. Because if you grow grapes in Carneros like you grow grapes in St. Helena,
yeah,
you don't have very good success.
Yeah.
So
there are so many people that always want to draw some kind of not just a latitude line, but a philosophical parallel to Burgundy. And the grape-growing climate in Burgundy, they don't have an issue with fog and all the wind that you have in Carneros, do they?
They have rain throughout the year there and some inclement weather and hail and other things.
Yeah.
And the history of Burgundy, they pick early and chaptalize almost, 90% of the time.
Because of the weather.
Because of the weather.
Yeah.
And their Appalachian laws, they preclude them harvesting before they get permission from the community to even start their harvesting in their effort to guard their quality. So Carneros,
Burgundy?
Yes.
So it's a lot easier. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think it's presumptuous of me to even say that. It's not that it's easier in Carneros. It's just very different. There are different considerations. And in Carneros, you're not allowed to chaptalize.
Well, not technically.
Oh, my gosh, really?
It's one of those things that was in California. You're allowed to chaptalize in America. But in California, there was an executive order that precluded chaptalization, the addition of sugar, historically, and required them to use grape juice concentrate if they needed to elevate sugars.
We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back.
This is Doug Frost, a wine writer and just a guy who likes to drink wine. If you want to know what all the geeks are up to, just keep listening to Lynn at Wine and Dine.
iWine Radio is a production of Food Tastes Better with Wine on the web at iWineRadio.com.
I'm Lynn Crelo Chamberlain.
Welcome to Wine and Dine.
You know, we just finished with Michael Richman this comment about Carneros, well, in California, not being allowed to chaptalize. Burgundy, they're allowed to add sugar. California, they're not. And where we left it off, he said that there was a way around it. We're talking about Bouchain Vineyards today. Bouchain Vineyards is located in the Carneros district of Napa Valley. And Bouchain is very, very much known for their presence as Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. But I've just enjoyed a Pinot Noir Rosé and a Pinot Gris. And let me ask you, so Michael, since you've seen this unfold, you say that there was a way that people were getting around this chaptalization issue in the 1980s, and the problem today is the opposite.
That's correct. Basically, there was just no enforcement, and winemakers were committed to making the highest quality wine. The law was, I don't know if it was just a publicity thing or if they were trying to make better quality from the big producers and not have them make
higher alcohol
wine.
Okay.
But so winemakers have always just been keen on making the best wine they could, and if it required the addition of a little sugar, then so be it. That's your job as a winemaker, is to balance your must with the sugar and the acid before you start your fermentation.
And now, as I've been talking to people about for so long, the problem is not enough ripeness in grapes. It's the opposite, too much ripeness and therefore unbalanced with respect to the acidity.
Yes, ma'am. And that's occurred because of a changing in the perspective on how to grow grapes.
Talk to us. So let's not label this as a global climate change. Talk to us about this.
No, it's not a global climate. It's a cultural change.
Okay.
Because back in those days, you never irrigated past veraison.
Okay.
And if you irrigated during the harvest, you were severely chastised and sanctioned for it. So the change came when we realized that that was opposite of growing good grapes. So you actually irrigate to prevent the grapes going into stress. And the problem with early California Pinot Noir was that without irrigation during harvest in these marginal regions, the grapes would go into stress, and in your effort to get them extra ripe, you had overripe, high-sugar green grapes.
Oh.
And so they ended up tasting like tomato juice and straw.
Oh.
So now we can irrigate judiciously late and prevent the grapes from going into stress, and so you get the higher sugars. That's part of it. The other part is a selection of clones that were isolated in Burgundy, which are almost universally used here in California, which are early ripening, and
okay.
So they tend to build sugar early as well.
Okay.
Also, our headlong pursuit of purifying the vines with heat treatment so that they are healthy. Well, a virus-free vine is not really natural, but so the vines are really healthy. They're healthy athletes now, and so they really build sugar and ripeness. So the industry, in some regards, is still, it's not its infancy, certainly its adolescence. And it's curious to say that about an industry that's hundreds of years old, to say it's in adolescence. But it is. We haven't seen the perfect matching of plant material to site outside of Europe in the world of wine. And that's an ongoing study.
That is so refreshing.
And it won't be in my generation.
That's so refreshing to hear you say that. I've never heard anyone say that. Do you consider yourself truly, even though your title, General Manager Winemaker, do you consider yourself more a grape grower or a vineyardist than a winemaker?
Probably philosopher.
Oh, okay.
This wine business is not very scientific, you know. It's based on empirical results. And so you try something. And it's a very soft science in as much as...
That was one of my questions. What do you mean by soft science?
I mean, there's so many variables, you can't control them all.
Okay.
I never say that we've got an experiment going. I say we have a trial going. Because you can't control all of the variables that you just have to make assumptions and live with the trial for several different years to arrive at a way to make wine and grow grapes. There is all kinds of, quote, scientific investigation where they try to do this, and so you take that as a point of departure, and you try it and see if it works for you. But it's an empirical science, not a carefully controlled science. Just too many variables in grape growing and in winemaking. That's the reason we love wine. It's because it's an adventure, and there's a great deal of uncertainty in the product. There's no two wines that are exactly the same. You give the same grapes to two different winemakers, they make two different wines. You grow the same clones and same grapes in two different pieces of land, they grow slightly different grapes. So it's a really... a moving target. It's a lifetime pursuit.
And at this stage of your career, would you ever, how do you feel about people who bill themselves as experts?
We're all experts, and none of us are experts.
Like you say,
you're an expert in your own opinion.
Well said. Yes, it's as you say, it's a lifelong pursuit.
Yes, and as I reach the end of my career now in wine, I feel at least humbled by what I don't know, and almost disappointed that I'm going out of this business knowing less than I knew when I started.
Well, when you started, you didn't know what questions to ask.
That's correct.
And experience
correct.
At least gives you a platform to start asking some questions.
That's correct. And you start challenging your assumptions, and you realize that some of the assumptions you lived with weren't right. The ground rules have changed, and so they're no longer right or appropriate, I should say. It's not a question of right or wrong. It's a question of appropriate.
Or valid. So in closing here, because we only have about a minute and a half left, talk to us about...
Well, that's too bad.
I know, but we're going to have to do this again, and I really hope to get Mrs. Copeland with us to maybe speak some other languages. The focus is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but you have a Rosé and a Pinot Gris, and what else is going on?
Yes, ma'am. We have a wine club called Bacchus Wine Club.
Okay.
And so we make an array of wines we call the Bacchus Collection.
Okay.
And this really stimulates the winemakers as much as anything by producing wines that are primarily for sale to wine club members and for sale here at the winery rather than wines that are in general national distribution. With the density of wineries and limited distribution channels, most distributors don't want many wines from you. They want one or two, not a dozen, because there's thousands of wineries out there. So we have what we call our core items, and then we have the Bacchus Collection items.
Okay.
And they include the wines like our Pinot Meunier,
Blanc. Oh, yeah, the Pinot Meunier was glorious.
Yes, and these other wines that have a lot of interest, but we make them only in 100 or 200 cases, and you have to be a wine club member or go on a website to discover them. And each of them has a story to tell.
Michael Richmond, General Manager Winemaker at Bouchain Vineyards, we thank you so very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Lynn. I feel like we just got started.
You're listening to iWine Radio.